şeyini biler.
Which one is Bert?
No, Bert is a
Bowerdiness.
Bowerdiness, that's the one. That's Kim's.
Uh-huh, okay.
And Eric and Vic are going to do stuff from.
Okay, let's close the door. Here, sit down. Or talk outside. Come on. Okay. Looks like we lost some people, but they're probably popping in. But better to start. The first session is about actually under the subject tools, like the previous was, and it's the new developments into the NSD and DNSSEC. And Erik gets the floor. He will take more than 5 minutes, but we actually subtracted from the other talk of NLNet Labs.
Hi, I'm Erik Roosendaal. I work for NLNet Labs, and I'm currently the main developer for NSD. I will give a little presentation on how we modified NSD to implement DNSSEC and how it affects its performance mainly. So what's NSD? NSD is an RFC compliant authoritative only name server, which means it gets to be very simple compared to other name servers, and which in turn leads to high performance. Adding DNS export to an authoritative only server is not very hard, but it did require some fundamental changes to NSD. The main difference is that in NSD1, the pre-DNSSEC version, we compiled the zones before running NSD and we stored all the possible answers in the database. And with NSD2, we changed that to store all the RR sets and we compose and encode the answers at runtime. The advantage of the NSD1 approach is the complexity is moved from the server to the zone compiler. The zone compiler needs to all do the could do all the work for determining RR sets to be included, it could pre-compute name compression. So the server was very simple and high performance. It only needed to look up the answer, update the compression pointers based on the query name, and finally send the answer to the client. The advantages of the NSD2 approach are a smaller database. We don't store entire answers, but just the RR sets. The database for the .NL zone, for example, changed from 126 megs to 46 megs. Memory usage is also reduced. We also have more flexibility in determining at runtime what to put in the answer. So for example, for DNSSEC, we can base it on the DNSSEC OK bits and some other criteria. And the overall complexity is slightly lower because the complexity of answering is no longer split between the zone compiler and the server itself. So why did we do this modification for DNSSEC? DNSSEC basically increases the zone size for .NL signed with a single RSA key. It's about a factor 5 increase in size. We need to store more answers if we pre-compute all answers for DNSSEC based on the DNSSEC OK bit. We need to store answers for the DS, NSSEC, and RRSIG RR sets. And we need to store answers for NX domain and no data responses with all the proper NSSEC records and RRSIG records added. We did a quick estimate of what the database size would be if we went to the NSD1 approach. We figured answer size would grow the same amount as the zone size, so about 5 times. We need to store 2 to 4 times more answers. So in turn, that would lead to a database that's about 10 to 20 times bigger, which is a very rough estimate. So a total database size of 1 to 2.5 gigabytes, which is pretty large and starts to run into 32-bit memory limits. And files that large are just a pain to deal with anyway. So we modified NSD2 just to store RR sets instead of answers. And memory usage was reduced like we expected. For example, with the .NL zone, the database size unsigned was 46 megs, signed was 251, which is about 5 times increase, which is about expected. Memory usage unsigned was 110 megabytes for NSD2 and about 400 megabytes for the signed zone. So it is very acceptable on standard PCs these days. First question lots of people ask when we say we changed the algorithm and made it more complex in the server is what about performance? So we did some performance comparisons. The algorithm, as you can see, is slightly more complicated. We need to analyze the query like NSD1. We look up all the RR sets for the query name. We encode the RR sets and perform name compression on the fly. And then finally get to send the answer to the client. So we did some performance comparison and the short and sweet answer is that performance is slightly less, but it's still very fast. Now we get to all the charts. Oh no, not yet. First we compared these servers, byte 8, byte 9, NSD1 and NSD2. I've also added an echo server, which is basically a do-nothing server. It only does the network part of a name server, so it copies the query from the client right back as the answer and sends it back. So we get an idea of the maximum possible performance on our platform and how close we are or aren't. The server hardware is off-the-shelf Athlon XP, about 2 GHz, 1 GB main memory, and 100 megabits network card. This performance comparison shows is done using a query trace from the K-Root server using the root zone. The horizontal axis shows the average number of queries per second. The vertical axis shows the percentage of queries that we got a response for. So as you can see, for NFV 1 and 2, about 20,000 queries per second, we start notice a slight difference. But NFV 2, with all the additional complexity, stays pretty close to NFV 1. The black line, the top line, shows the error curve, which is sort of the our maximum possible performance. And we're actually pretty close to that, so I think we're doing a good job there. Binds 8 and 9 could still use some improvement. But they are also, of course, a lot more complicated piece of software. For the .NL zone, NFV 1 and 2 are much closer than for the root zone. That's mainly because we spent more time in name lookup. There are about a million domain names we need to look up, compared to about 600 for the root zone. This also why NFV 1 dropped a little bit more from the maximum possible echo server. Bind 8 and 9 are again low performance. The interesting thing is that in my test, bind 9 now is faster than bind 8. So I guess for CC TLDs, bind 9 might actually be a good, better choice than bind 8. NSD, of course, also a very good choice. We also did a little comparison on how DNSSEC affects performance. Here we have only running NSD, we don't have a bind release yet with DNSSEC. So we got three different zones. We serve an unsigned route using normal query trace, serving a signed route, so the zone is slightly large because it includes RR6 and NSSEC, and a modified NSD server which assumes the DNSSEC OK bit is set on every query, so we do full DNSSEC processing with NSSEC records and RR6. You notice the difference between the unsigned route and the signed route, which are the blue lines. There's basically no noticeable difference. So you can easily serve a signed route and not notice anything. If you assume that the O bit is set, there is a pretty big difference. At about 20,000 queries a second, you notice a big drop. Unlike the previous chart where we had a big drop, this was caused by CPU being the bottleneck. In this case, it was network bandwidth being the bottleneck. Because the answers are larger, you get to fill up the 100 megabit network pretty quickly. There's a second little bump, about 43,000 queries. That's probably where CPU becomes the bottleneck again and no longer bandwidth. That's the last one. We did the same for the NL zone. Here there is a slight difference in performance between the unsigned and the signed zone, probably because the NL zone is pretty large, so less cache behavior. Assuming that the O bits is set, it also causes a slight drop, but it's not nearly as large as with the root zone. And this is probably because in the root zone there are a lot of queries for non-existing domains, and those answers are pretty big. You need to include two NSSEC records, usually with RR6 and stuff like that. With the NL zone, you usually get the delegation, which is, I think, a bit smaller. So, conclusions and what are our next steps? NSD2 performs pretty well. With or without DNSSEC, you can actually start surfing signed zones as soon as DNSSEC gets standardized, without having to worry too much about performance from the server side. We will release NSD2 next month. We will have DNSSEC disabled by default. You can enable it, but it's there's still draft standards, so the standards might change and then you will be incompatible. As soon as DNSSEC is standardized, we will release an update which will enable DNSSEC by default. I would also like people, if they serve authoritative zones and have traces, to send them to us if they want, because we can do more regression testing that way. Right now we regression test against binds using the root traces and NL traces. The problem is that those zones are delegation only zones, so that's the part that gets tested most. Stuff like wildcard expansion and are tested manually, which is just so not as well tested as the root and NL zones. So that's about it. Thank you. And any questions?
The competitor. work with friends more than a competitor. Well, first, NSD is actually great, so people should definitely think at least having a mix of different implementations in their systems. I have one question that I have meaning to ask Daniel for a long time about the graphs, but I always forget, but since that was the opportunity. Can you show one of the graphs, any of the graphs, the performance graphs?
Yeah, which one?
Any of them. It's any about the shape of them. Okay, if I understand correctly, you do this by doing traffic samples from the real systems and then running them, rerunning them against target systems in the lab. When I run a system, I really want the system to answer all queries, not just 40% of queries. So I tend to be more interested in the upper left corner of it.
Yeah.
Now my question is, due to the nature of how the plotting is, that's a very small part and it's really hard. One concern I have is when this percentage of answered queries goes down beyond a certain level, I don't know which level that would be, then the traffic sample you have will no longer reflect the reality because you'll essentially have dropped queries and in real life that would generate new queries. So, and as more of these queries are dropped, you'd basically be doing what you'd call thrashing in a using. So basically, is there a way, do you have an estimate at which percentage of dropped queries these simulated input would differ from what you see in reality under the same conditions, in the same load? And if you have any idea of that, then would you consider making available that the graphs that affect that display the information contained in that region, like from 100% queries to when the system starts thrashing, basically, so that I get a better idea of what's the realistic load I can expect the servers to be able to handle out there in the world.
Yeah. I don't really have an idea what would actually happen in that case. The main reason is, for example, if you look at this root server case, the actual trace has an average number of queries per second about 3,400. Mm-hmm. That's all the way to the left, and all servers are pretty much at 100% there.
Mm-hmm.
So in most cases, that simply will not happen. But it would be interesting to have a program that tests this and look if there are responses, and if not, resend requests to see at what point things would break.
Yeah.
It could be interesting to test.
My answer is the same. I don't know whether your assumption is true. And then I think we should take this offline. The intent of this was basically to do a test that is as realistic as possible from the user point of view. And it is useful, even the right-hand sides are useful if you do local load sharing. Because then you can see, so if I have two machines, you can make some guesses. But I agree with you. It's not an absolutely realistic scenario because of the retransmissions. But what I don't understand is how the retransmission would be different from more queries. Generates artificial log. Okay. Okay. But still, I think these are useful. What I didn't understand, and I don't want to put you on the spot and waste much time. But what I didn't understand was on the last ones, why your reasoning why the drop happens so quickly on the left hand side. It goes it goes lower than 100% so quickly on the left hand side.
For this trace, you mean?
I think it's even clearer in the last one. Yeah. Because I don't see how unsigned.nl is different from the earlier ones. And in the earlier ones it stayed close to 100% much longer.
Does it? Well, it's a slightly later NL zone. It's about 6 months newer, so there are a few more domains. But I don't think there's a big difference there, because NL also drops the red line, and NSD 1.4 also drops pretty quickly from 100% here.
Okay, let's take it offline. I think it's a detail.
Yep. Any other questions?
Okay, then.
All right.
Thanks, Erik. It's interesting, huh? And now the next one is Power DS. Let's hear it. And let's switch to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
See
if it works. It's A, right? Ah. Something's worked. But
try again. The kid was probably. C kid.
C. You cannot read.
Ah.
Ah, that's better.
Okay, well, I'm happy to address this great crowd at RIPE. So far, we haven't been very much a part of the standards generating community or the DNS community at all, and I'm not sure if this presentation will help. Okay, what will I speak about? What is Power DNS? What did we do differently? Our general attitude towards standards, performance, etc. Some notes about C++ and threads, which are both hot items. What do we suck at? Quite a number of things. Some notes on performance, about the recursive name server, which I actually think is one of the more remarkable parts of PowerDNS. A lot of stuff we learned, and then some ranting about the future of DNS. Okay. PowerDNS is an open source name server. We started out as a proprietary product. More about that later. It is a fully recursive name server. Well, what do I mean by that? There are name servers out there that claim to recurse, but in fact iterate. So each time you send a packet, they move one step beyond in the recursion process, but they don't actually go all the way with the first query. We do full master and slave support. There's a list of databases we support, and I think I missed a few. But I think you should be well satisfied with this. One of the more interesting things is the pipe backend, which allows you to have RDNS view queries in a value key format to any process that's listening on a standard input and generating answers from standard outputs. That means that, for example, there's an example backend included, which is 50 lines of Perl. And this backend needs to know nothing about DNS details, it just needs to see a tuple question and return a number or answers or no answer. It does Unix and Windows. The port for Windows is surprisingly easy. We asked a friend of the company and we hired him for a month and then the port to Windows was done. We also do full IPv6 support, which is fun. Okay, we started out as a commercial company with a closed source proprietary product, which did not fare very well. We need an aggressive sales force to market closed source products, and we are basically open source people at heart, so we have a hard time doing that kind of thing. We let the C++ standard template library do a lot of the heavy lifting. You will find no red-black trees within PowerDNS. You will find no binary trees within PowerDNS. You will find no auto-sizing arrays within PowerDNS. You will find, however, maps, multi-maps, sets, and vectors, which are pretty cool. We use some threading. It sucks for performance, so we frown upon it. And we use fibers. Fibers are done using the toolkit mTasker. These are not really threads. They implement cooperative multitasking. They are basically used in the recursor. More about that later. Zone files are just one of the data sources. That was actually zone files were added later, when we figured out that the zone file was a database too. We don't support every operating system under the sun. That's not a design goal. We support operating systems that people use and ask us about. For example, HP UX won't work. SCO, I don't want it. Yeah. I don't have it either, so it's easy.
We want to conform to relevant standards, but if a standard speaks about the zone file and we run without the zone file, we don't sweat over it. If the standard has some silly old-fashioned behavior in it which is no longer appropriate, we don't follow it. It's not a goal. We do, however, want to be a friendly netizen, but more about that later. And one of the interesting things we do is, reminds me a bit of the NSD Echo server. If we see a packet we've seen before, we don't even parse it. We look at where the question is, and we look no further. And if it has a match, we just spit out the same answer we sent out previously, which basically saves. I think we timed it, and it was below the microsecond time frame we needed for that. So, and no system calls between receiving the packet and sending the answer out. Okay, what do we suck at? Quite a lot. We are incredibly naive when it comes to EDMS0, or I'm not even sure what it's called. We just send out packets of 512 octets, that's the maximum size, otherwise we truncate, even if the name server indicates that it can accept bigger ones. It never happens, I time it. I never need to send bigger answers, but we wouldn't do them anyhow. We will, however, happily accept larger answers that indicate that they are not truncated. Recursor, it works very well. Lots of people use it under high load, and I use it all the time on a big mailing list, but I haven't really been able to test the BigQuery support a lot, and it's not a well-stressed piece of code, so it might fall over. As I said before, we do threading, which tends not to be very good performance-wise, so we try to do as little threading as possible. Most queries are answered within a single thread and never switch threads, never happens. Then again, MySQL and PostgreSQL now offer asynchronous interfaces. That means that we could do without threads altogether, because we can just field queries to them and see answers come in. We don't have to generate multiple parallel connections to do that, or these multiple parallel threads execution. We should do something about that. We haven't done that. Solaris support. Many of the big players still use Solaris, which we would want to support, but that we have no sun. So basically what happens, every once in a while our release breaks on Solaris, and then people say, well, it broke, and then they send me the debugger, the compiler outputs, or what went wrong, and then I fix it again. But this means that a new release, while known to work on Linux and FreeBSD, most of the time Windows, may not work on Solaris. The packet parser. Basically, Parity has started out as a packet parser. That was the first lines of code. And they are 3 years old, and they were my first C++ program. It needs replacing badly. It works, but it's long, and it's ugly. So if there are volunteers who want to write the ultimate packet parser, know where to find me. And then one thing that will hurt people. We store IPv6 and IPv4 addresses as ASCII. Wasting precious bits and bytes. And we had many discussions over that, and it turned out quite often we waste a few megabytes here and there on large zones. It hurts. But it has made for far, far easier code. This will be solved one day, but right now, for 99% of people, it's not a problem. So I'm not going to obfuscate the code to please those three people in the world who need a wonderful 50,000 packets a second support that we've seen, which is impressive. But I'm not willing to make my code more complex to support three people. So please use NSD. Okay, our attitude. We want stuff to work well. There are no Daniel Bernstein. If something makes me feel bad that we need it, if something makes me feel bad or it's required by standards, which is thought to be relevant, we will do it. However, one of the most often asked questions about PowerDNS is, I don't see any authority records. No, we don't add them. Nobody looks at them. They are cruft. They are most of the time confusing, so we don't add them. And the RFC says they are optional. So we're not adding them. Security is very important. The stuff that says, well, this is the zone I got the information from. Security over everything. It also ties in with the IPv addresses are strings. I don't want to peek and poke into bytes and do complicated offset and packet parsing. I want boring strings. We want to be a friendly netizen. Most name servers, recursive name servers, act as query multipliers. When fed queries for name servers that are lame or don't respond, and that's generally considered a bad idea. So from the start, the recursive name server throttles its queries. We want to give answers that are always parsed well. And we follow the robustness principle. So we're not going to throw out packets that look a bit weird to us. But we try to send ones that look very okay. We're not very interested in newfangled DNS developments. Many years of efforts each month are spent on DNSSEC and IPv6 and complicated things I don't really understand. I wait for my users to ask for a feature. And they ask for quite a lot, so even the stuff that's far away on the horizon we hear about. But if no one ever has asked me for something, I'm not bothering implementing it. Okay, again, the ASCII stuff, I feel bad about it, so I listened twice. Okay, some C++ and threads evangelism. There are people out there who say, well, PowerDNS uses threads, uses C++, I won't use it. And these people are very vocal. I don't think they're very important, but they are very vocal. So I wish to address them. Many of the C++ programmers write large blobs of programs. This is not a feature of C++. This is a feature of C++ programmers. We're not like that. I did 10 years of straight solid programming in C before I discovered C++, and I took my C attitudes with me. The thing in the middle is interesting. That is the entire data structure of the PowerDNS recursor. This is why I said that you won't find any red black trees or whatever. I don't know what the name is. I know that the C++ standard guarantees me complexity requirements. Because when I generate a map string, the string is the query in the form of the domain and then the slash and then the number indicating the query type. And on the right hand side of my associative array is a set of resource records. The C++ standard guarantees me that if I do a lookup, and it will scale O n log n, or better, or probably do better. Same thing said. I have no clue what's beneath it. I don't need to go. It's great. It generates better code than 99% of people will write. This is not a C++ building. It generates an actual tree in code, which assembles down to nothing. So if I had to write this stuff out myself, this one line, I would probably double the size of the PowerDNS recursion. I don't want to do. Well, the concurrent programming stuff, that's especially to the recursor, we have no complicated state machines. State machines rock when it comes to performance, they don't rock when it comes to code that's transparent and easy to understand. So almost everything in PowerDNS you can read sequentially and see what happens when. And when it's done, the packet is done. Performance. Okay, we strive to offer the operator choice. Do you want high performance? Do you want high features? Do you want to know what PowerDNS is doing? Or do you just trust it? We keep the threading to a minimum. Most answers are generated within a single thread, which never switches. Some features have a performance cost, so you can turn them off. You can turn off CNAMEs, which is good because it instantly halves the query load on your backend. And if you know you have no CNAMEs in your zones, well, as many root zones do, or many CCTLD zones do, why look for them? You can turn off wildcards, which everybody should do. You can switch off out-of-zone additional processing. That's a bit of a dangerous feature. Let's say you have a web, let's say you are a zone, what are they called? These people who do public DNS providers, where you can configure zones. And then we have somebody else who entered the Microsoft.com zones in their database. The zone is generated. And suddenly, somebody else has Microsoft.com as an MX record. Then the name server will happily do additional processing from its own database. So if you have untrusted users filling your database, then you should not do additional processing. out of your outside of your own zone, because bad people may be filling your server with bogus data. You can turn it off, and it's also performance boost. You can turn off IPv6 for processing, which also saves some queries in the recursion. You can turn off logging, and same as with bind, you can say, well, I want very high performance zone transfers with multiple answers per packet. Then there's another thing which I neglected to mention. PowerDNS is a very cool web server built in. It's all by default because it's dangerous, but it generates very lovely statistics on who is querying you and what the query rates are, what the backend rates are. And it's very instructive to see why is my database slow, or who is querying me, or do I have any lame zones delegated to me, or am I lame for zones that are delegated to me. You can turn that off as well, because everything comes at a cost. Out of the box, we are not configured for performance. We are configured for standards compliance and doing what people expect it to do. We are, however, configured out of the box for the ability to serve millions of zones without any tuning. Okay, specific performance features. This is going to hurt. We don't check for a sign of authority there. We assume that the operator is competent, and that's there. This is mostly true. This means if a query comes in and it's there, we perform only one database query. We don't go looking for the best SOA mesh out there, which we should do, but we don't. As long as the operator is competent, this works, which is, of course, asking a lot. We do a whole packet caching, as I said before. We spoof in the correct ID so that we can send out the right answer to the right question. We cache entire database queries, because quite often if there's a need for additional processing, there will be many, many of the identical lookups, and we don't want to go to the database each time.
Very good question. You fumble with the DTL, right?
Sorry?
You fumble with the DTL, right?
Yeah, that's a tricky bit.
Good
question. No, we don't. We keep the query, the packet cache, to be pretty short. So it's not an hour. It's more in the order of minutes. So again, we get the trade-off involved between reparsing the packet and re-spoofing the DTL. But as the standard packet cache is set at 10 seconds, we didn't feel it was worth it. Well, we don't add additional fluff records unless they are needed. So if nobody will ever look at them, or if they can only be confusing, we don't bother to go find them in the database. I think bind calls is tiny answer mode or small answer mode. We don't have a big answer mode. Okay, the recursor, which is
actually the part I think is relatively most interesting.
There's cooperative multitasking using mTasking. That means that the code looks as if it is using threads. It appears as if each packet has its own thread. That's not true. It was very clever cooperative multitasking whereby threads are switched each time a query would be sent out to the network. This means that there are only 1,200 lines of code. It's probably smaller than the bind configuration part, or probably smaller than the bind zone part, probably smaller than the red lexi in NSD. This is due to C++, not to my genius. It has, even for its relatively low number of lines, quite a number of features. Just the very cycle of the removal. It's there, it's in standby. I hope it won't be needed again, but if they start to act weird again, it will work. We do query plotting. We have three categories, and it turns out that on a quite busy name server, up to 30% of all queries are plotted, which is a good thing. And at first I didn't believe it, but well, PowerDNS is being too restrictive, it's being too careful. But many a query is caused by domains that don't work, because those queries need to be sent again, again, again. So if you have a large mail queue and the mail queue is being run, generally the mail queue is filled with domains for which the name server doesn't work. So you will see many, many questions being repeated. And it makes no sense to keep asking. So we throttle quite a lot, and in some circumstances that rises to 95%. But we save the world a lot of packets. Recently we also added the fastest name server selection, with the decaying average return time. It means that the name server was previously slow. PowerDNS will think that if it waits long enough, it will be fast again. Try to reevaluate its
average response time. And that also, I did a benchmark and it improved the speed from a cold cache by a factor of 2, so it's worthwhile. Okay, that's a trace mode, which is very verbosely prints out what it's doing. This is good for me to debug, it's also good for users to debug their VNet problems. Because it also mentions stuff like name server names, which would never be found because you need the IP address of the name server to figure out the IP address of the name server, or the glue loops, or non-glue loops. Some time ago, most of .cn dropped off the net because of this, which we don't generally notice a lot from here, except if we reject some more spam. It has a memory cache, and it has a persistent cache. This is only a CVS, not yet released. But if you want to, you can just keep your cache on this. It internally uses time to die, but instead of time to live, so if you wait long enough, your entire cache and disk will have expired. But it's still there. As I mentioned before, it's fully recursive, which means that even the most nasty domains which require this, there is one domain out there, I think Dan Bernstein mentioned it, runsheet.de, I think, and it took like 25 queries to get. Well, since then they fixed it, I think because Bernstein mentioned it, but PowerUnit did it out of the box. I think byte 8 needs 4 tries, and byte 9 does it out of the box, so that's good. Well, performance is good. I often feed it a log file from my web server, and it's generally very fast. The bad news is it does not work on some of the older versions of FreeBSD. I use the, I think they're 20 years old functions, set context, get context, make context, and swap context. And for some reason or other, these are not in older FreeBSD releases. They are working on it. OpenBSD does not have it either, but they told me that they will fix that very shortly. So it does work on Windows, which was easy to do. Okay, stuff we learned. A database has a lot of flexibility. Operators of large numbers of zones and ISPs, they just love it. They can retire servers by doing one whopping SQL statement. You and I would do that kind of thing with CNAMEs, but not everybody is as smart as you and I. It comes at a cost. You generally require a bigger machine. It will generally be somewhat slower. You won't do 50,000 packets a second from Postgres to all. It won't happen. However, people with 1 million zones, people with 3 million zones, and they have all tested power demons, they save so much time during startup and zone reloading or making changes or not even reloading that they gladly buy a bigger box. One of the nice things about PowerDNS is that you can generate one single picture of all your domains. You have one big machine that does all of them. You don't need to look up, well, I store domains from 1 to 50,000 from this machine or from 50,000 to 100,000 from that machine. I know that register.com has, I think, 48 different name servers installations, which each are two machines. So they keep continuing to figure out on which name server is a domain. And that's tricky. Benchmark tiers. I hate them. They take PowerDNS out of the box. They take an unconfigured machine. One guy did a benchmark on a 48 megabyte Pentium laptop. He installed PostgreSQL in the slowest mode there was. His machine will start from memory from the beginning. And he made big noise about how slow PowerDNS was, and he didn't want to change anything. He said, well, Bind works well on this machine, so PowerDNS should work well on this machine too. Which is admirable, but if he had done some work, PowerDNS would not have stuck to 7 packets per second, which is, of course, sad. They won't do anything. They will just take the program out of the box, and if it's slow out of the box, they will report it as being slow. Even though you have a chapter called performance tuning in the manual, they won't read it. So I'm pondering to have one single performance switch that will make PowerDNS be fast and stop all logging. Because PowerDNS by default, it tells you something that you may need to know. It tells you people are asking you questions about domains you do not have in your database. It will tell you.
because it considers that something that's important for you to know. Somebody delegated the domain to you do not have, which is useful, but makes things slow. Logging kills performance 100%. Logging a single line is about as hard as doing 100 packets. So turn it off if you want performance. Well, we were very happy with C++. Everybody said it wouldn't work, and with portability, it would be slow. With Remco from Moma, who's here too, compared to, we did some performance testing when we were on the fringes of a CCTLD tender, and we managed to achieve 50,000 packets a second with 100% answers or so coming in. So it can be real fast if you want to. You just don't run it from PostgreSQL, but if you run it from the Fred database or this new database of Berkeley Sleepy Cat, it will achieve that kind of performance. Okay, some more. PowerDNS as a company is almost defunct. PowerDNS as a company is me. I get some random consulting jobs out of PowerDNS, which helped me with your life, which is good. But then again, we quit doing PowerDNS as a big company with employees about a year ago. It turns out, in the meantime, PowerDNS has grown to be a very big program. We now see routinely over 1,000 downloads a week. Last week we saw 1,500. For a name server, that's quite a lot. Bind probably does more, but for me it's a lot. We have a mailing list with 600 people on it. It's also a lot for me. It took even longer before we start getting the first open source magic to work. When we got people not only telling us that we had a problem, but fixing the problem. That took longer. Right now we have a few people sending us actually very good patches. We also have some people sending us very bad patches. And that's something you need to learn to deal with. Because you think somebody sent me this wonderful work, this light work, and I need to accept it. But you don't need to accept it. If it sucks, it sucks, even if somebody works very hard on it. I still have to learn that. I have merged some crap. And I have to fix it again. Don't try to sell non-open source name servers to people. It works very badly. If you want to do that, you need to offset that with huge marketing efforts and conferences and everything. It doesn't work very well. You won't also want to sell support. People don't do it. Maybe the very big people will do it, but even very professional registrars that use our software, they go for the €1,000 a year support contract, which gives you the right to call me and I need to answer within a week. It baffles me. You won't be able to live from that. Demand for DNSSEC. We see a lot of noise about DNSSEC. People want it, and we say, well, we're not going to do it. We're not only going to consider it when DNSSEC is done in 6 months. We've been saying that for the past 2 years, and I venture I will consider you saying that for a while.
For the past 10 years.
Okay. Thank you, Roy. It's even worse. So, once DNSSEC is there, perhaps we'll look at it. I'm skeptical. When people ask us for DNSSEC, we say, we're not doing it, and say, oh, okay. And then they move on. And then they deploy PowerDNS anyhow. So, yeah. People want to be able to say, we do DNSSEC. They don't actually want to do it. Okay, this is one of the biggest lessons we learned. Some of you may have heard about the last January 10th this year, when the number of seconds since 1970 dropped over 2 to the 30 bits. When we wrote the code, we intended to stop below. It says, this is 2038, the number of seconds that happened since 1970. Instead, we wrote the above, and it turns out that the above evaluates to the 10th of January 2004. That means that on the 10th of January 2004, PowerDNS considered eternity to have passed. Internally, there is a timer that says every 10 seconds or every 60 seconds, look over any domains that have new SOA serial numbers and go check if they need to have the update sent out. And initially it said, well, only do that if eternity has passed. And well, that passed rather quickly. And I was at the birthday of my girlfriend at that time. And I had a phone call, said, well, PowerDNS is acting weird, doing 3,000 SQL queries a second and it's being slow. Well, it's still working. Yeah, it's still working. It's being slow. No way. And then some other people called me and said, well, you really need to look at this because for us, it is working, but our MySQL database is going down and our billing is going down. And So, and then the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, and the seventh people will call in. That's about time to break out the laptop and then leave the party. And then a friend of mine who was a fully trained year 2000 problem solver, he fixed the problem in 5 minutes, which is impressive. He spotted the problem immediately. He just passed. I'm very happy with it. So within a few hours, we released the patch. But if you ever need to do C, the left shift operator doesn't bind as tight as you would think. The minus operator binds more tight. Okay, now we turn to the ranting session. We have a DNS work group. We have no address resolution protocol work group. I would venture to say that DNS is nothing but the ARP of IP. Layer 3 ARP, if you will. It's not that big a thing. DNS is a container of IP addresses and MX records. That's 99% of the content of DNS. We have lots of other records. They don't matter at all. DNS is the prime example of a robust distributed directory containing small data items. It's very good. I think 40% of all name servers are misconfigured in some way and still works. It's impressive. However, this is not a virtue of many of the limitations we struggle with. It's a virtue because we kept things simple, we kept things robust. It's a virtue that we are robust against 40% misconfigured domains. The energy spent on DNS extensions, and there are many, in the past 10 years, I think some of the finest minds, because I admire the DNSSEC people, because they are so smart, I don't even follow them anymore. Whenever a talk ventures into key signing keys, and secondary key signing keys, zone signing keys, delegation signer keys, my good senses leave the building. Corey.
They are just another record.
I know, but the semantics around those records...
You don't need to know the semantics, Scott. It's just another record.
It's another record, I know. I would love to just serve another record and be done with it, but then I have NXT records and I have to... line of sight, DNSSEC. I tried it. I really tried it. I sat down. Well, it can't be that hard. It's too hard for me. Which may be saying more about how smart you are than about how stupid I am. With the energy spent on DNSSEC, we could have been in super DNS, DNS the next generation, 3 times over. Okay, these are the things we would do differently. If you would redesign DNS today, we would just make a record that said, well, there is no record this type. So you would not infer that from flags in the packet header. It would be a record that you could easily cache and say, well, next few hours, don't try it, it won't be there. The same for the record type. I would add a signature field to all records. I would not ask magic signatures. Which would come after a record. This is my random ranting on how I would redesign DNS. I would have the ability to ask for an IPv4 or an IPv6 record and not do that in two queries. Or ask for the MX record in one go and not just have to do any record in any case, which is dangerous anyhow. Expand the ID space to 32 bits, solving quite a lot of the DNS problems we face today. Label compression is dangerous. It's fraught with complications. Keeps turning up in bugs. There are far simpler compression algorithms out there, which just compress the whole packet. Okay, this is really the last slide, so I will finish now. I would love to have a situation where you can negotiate secure context with a name service. Even the stub resolver that does not need the complexity of everything with DNSSEC and say, well, now I have a secure channel with this name server. Zone deprovisioning protocol, that's one of the biggest questions. People say, well, I have lots of DNS peers, like I have BGP peers, but I would love to be able to send them automated messages, please remove this zone from your server, or please add this zone to your server. Right now, there is no standard for that, and that hurts people. That hurts people a lot, far more than the lack of secure DNS does. UDP is cool. TCP is not. It would be great if DNS servers could figure out how large the packets they could send dynamically. And just having a server say, well, I can handle 1500 byte packets is not going to cut it, because with tunnels and tunnels and tunnels and tunnels, what you think may work may in fact not work. So So in AmpServe we need to figure that out. Binary is cool. Everybody's saying XML DNS should leave the room. Serial numbers are cool. Delegation to IP addresses is wrong. Because in many cases people say, well, I know this is the IP address and I don't want name service to go out and figure it out. I don't want to add additional names for a name service. I can do it blue now. I just want to delegate this IP address. And if it changes, I'll tell the registrar or the registry. Rsync like zone modifications. They would be very cool too. Right now the dynamic update things and the expert things, they require full state to be kept, full changes, by whatever medium they came in. Which requires that the data that power that your name server actually has a big diff database of everything that happened. It's not a name server core functionality. But some people would say, well, tell me which are the domains between this bit and this bit the same? Yeah, they are. Rsync is a great algorithm for that and would also be able to work over DNS. Summarizing, DNS is the arc of IP. If some tools decide to look elsewhere, we're lost. So keep things simple. DNS, in my view, is not well suited for complicated enhancements. We have small packets, it's easily spoofed. We have very specific semantics. We've seen that with over the past 10 years that just adding another record, which is cool, adds a host of complications with wildcards and non-existing records and everything. It's not a very good base for doing everything.
Those complications were already there. DNSSEC just made them more clear.
Yeah, and that's I'm not blaming DNSSEC. It's more that DNS is perhaps not a very good base for DNSSEC. However, DNS remains the coolest protocol around because it's everywhere. It's in your phone. It's everywhere. It works. With possible exception, TCP is the coolest thing around. And that ends my presentation. Thanks. Are there any questions?
I'll have to keep this question very, very quick. So, quick question, very quick answer because we're over time. You said that your server doesn't fill in the authority section of the answers it serves out. What about the case of no data and NX domain responses?
In that case, we'll
fill it out. Fine, thank you.
Well, the last quick question, gosh, we only have time. State your name, please, for the web.
Monsen Suisi from AFNI. Very quick question. As far as I know, you don't implement TSIG. TSIG for securing, for example.
No, but that's one thing we would like to add.
Okay, because we lack that. Yeah, last year we did some interrupt for IETF. For TSIG, and we discovered that PowerDNS doesn't implement it, and it was a pity. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Mikhail, and I'm going to talk a little bit about DNSSEC. And I will make it very short. Already, this presentation I've given in Pisa for a center, and I've trimmed some slides of it, and I'll just start. What we've done last year is run an experiment in .NL called SECREG, which signed the .NL zone, and where people could get their domains signed in DNSSEC 3. This was the first time this experiment was done in a real TLD zone, CCTLD zone. We want to test the new DNSSEC drafts, the post 2535 and the VS record. We wanted to get hands-on experience with the new drafts, develop and test the new procedures you're going to get for DNSSEC, and see what can be automated and whatnot. And the impact on the registry, the registrants, and the registrars for DNSSEC. How did we do it? We used a shadow setup of name servers, and we just signed those the NL zone and loaded them on those servers. So you have to know which servers were running the signed NL zone. It was completely separate of the normal .NL zone. We had one name server at SIDN, one server at NL at Labs at our own office, one secondary in Sweden, The HFR went okay. And we secured, of course, the HFR, this DSIC. The secured NL zone, as Eric said, was around 300 megabytes in size. Well, once a day the zone was transferred to Sweden and to the other name servers. So wasn't a problem. I built a DNSSEC registry where people could register their DNSSEC or their domain names and add keys, and those were loaded in the signed zone. Two providers helped me doing that. One was BIT, the other was Extended Internet. And the make secure operation was automated. The key rollover, if you wanted to use a new key, it could be automated. If you wanted to change your contact address, of course, could also be automated. And you could block your zone. If you lose your key, or if you knew your key was stolen, you could go to the website and tell that, and then the zone would be dropped from the experiment. We had some checks running to keep the NL zone and the secured zone in sync. This all worked up until we had a huge amount of zones in the secure zone, because I had to use Whois do the checks, and a single Whois cost me 10 seconds or something. And at one point we had 15,000 zones, and the Whois checks for all those zones were running into 36 hours or something. So I had to skip that and make some changes, but it was not related to DNSSEC at all. If a change was found, then the zone was dropped from the experiment, because the NL zone was the most important thing for us. And it all worked out okay. At one point, we have 15,000 domains under the experiment, which had keys and were signed and were delegated. And it was the largest signed zone on Earth up until today. And as I said, there were a few from BIT and a few from Extended Internet. At the time, because the experiment's now stopped, we had 350 megabytes of zone file, which is not that large. The signing took only 1.5 hours. The loading was 50 minutes. We saw very little next walks. The one we saw were the ones we were doing ourselves. There was one interesting operational problem, that was the secondary in Sweden was running out of its memory and thereby not accepting new HFRs from us. And as the signature lifetime on the records was 1 week, we had a 1 week period when that wasn't a problem. After that 1 week, the people who were using the secondary in Sweden would have gotten bad answers from that secondary. And it took 1.5 weeks to get the secondary fixed. So for 3 or 4 days, people were getting no answers at all for the NL zone, which is bad. So if you're going to do DNSSEC, you need to know that you can contact your secondaries at the instance and to shut them down, because it's better to shut the machine down than to serve bad data. What we found was almost everything can be automated. If you think about it, it's not really hard to come up with stuff, email forms or web forms or whatever. The signing is no problem. The serving is no problem. The zone size is not a problem, at least not for .NL. Maybe one zone has a problem here. The next walking is also not a problem, if you see. Roy?
I'm sorry to interrupt the presentation once again. What do you mean by automating key compromise? Because that reads scary.
What you can do is you can have a form that informs the parent that the key is compromised, and have the form signed with the compromised key.
In the case that the key is compromised, you can automate the handling of that event.
Yeah, but with the risk of having the attacker roll over the key to an attacker's key. So the biggest manual thing that's going to be happening with DNSSEC is that people lose their keys and the registry has to set up a new key. And that's the only thing you cannot automate. At one time we rolled over the root key of .NL, which was no problem because there were no resolvers configured with that root key. That's also a big issue. If somebody loses the key of .NL or root, and we have 150 billion resolvers with that key on Earth, those need updating. So I hope people will never lose the key. If there are problems, 46-bit machines are cheap already and will solve everything. I'm going to skip the first bullet. The main thing we found for DNSSEC was that we saw the need for a new contact. Next to in Holland, we have the technical contact and the admin C. We saw the need for a new contact, that's the zone contact. That's the guy, or girl, who owns the private key and can edit a zone file and can re-sign a zone file. And to see the difference, the technical contact edits or controls the name server, the zone contact controls the zone. And that's the thing, the most important lesson we learned from the experiment. We're going to need a new contact, the zone contact. First we called it the security contact, but that meant, yeah, DNSSEC is not security, so we moved the name to zone contact. A new thing for a registry is to public, publicize in the public key, and with DNSSEC you will get more emphasis on security. But you should have good security already, especially if you're registered. And you need to handle key compromises, of course. We did not find serious bugs in the protocol. Too bad bind 9.3 didn't work as well. We should do the experiment again with bind 9.4, which will probably work better. But yeah, there's nothing planned yet. So this is what we're going to see happening. NSD and bind will be fully DNSSEC aware in the coming 6 months. So if the protocol is ready, we release at least a new version of NSD. And I do not really know what the plans for DLNL are for DNSSEC. But currently they're working on a new registration system, which will incorporate DNSSEC. My guess is that will take a year, and then another year to get it ready for a real DNSSEC deployment. So if we're really lucky, and the protocol is really finished in 6 months, and now could deploy DNSSEC in 2 years. Is that, can I say that?
You are saying.
That was it. Thank you. Were any questions?
Oh, thank you. Now we ran over to Puso, who has to cut his talk short as well. And then we have to switch to the other one. And let me find his boom. Yeah. PDF, okay, here we go. Come on, go out.
Okay, as I mentioned in my talk earlier this week, IDNs have been a fairly key part of Centre's work in recent times. Most registries within Europe have a game plan when it comes to IDNs. For many are deciding to deploy it. Those that aren't deploying it straight away have serious plans about how to deal with it in the next 1 or 2 years. Now, when I mentioned this topic for the DNS forum, we thought back and realised that there hasn't actually been an explanation on how IDNs actually work within this area. So I thought I would add some extra slides in to discuss the basic concepts of IDN. However, due to time concerns, I'll probably have to fly through them relatively quickly. Essentially what IDNs are is an extra layer on the DNS. It doesn't change the underlying DNS whatsoever. It really adds an extra layer that translates between the Unicode world and the ASCII world of DNS. The Unicode world is based on a subset of Unicode 3.2, which allows you many thousands of character options that can be expressed in a domain name. As it is an extra layer, it doesn't change the underlying DNS protocol. It just adds an extra layer of complexity, if you will. But it does mean that no DNS servers need to change, no resolver libraries need to change. To support IDNs, all that needs to change is the end user applications. This is just a very small selection of Unicode characters, which I'm showing because I'll use them as examples later on, but Unicode, I think, has over 100,000 code points now that should really be able to express most of the world's languages. And pretty much, well, they're all available at that URL at the top. This IDN layer that's been added to the DNS, what it does is it converts between the two different forms of domain names, being the Unicode domain name, that the internationalized domain name that we want to see at the end user point, and also the ASCII domain, the converted domain that travels across the internet in LDH form. To do this, obviously, they need to be encoded. An encoding scheme is used, which is called Punicode, but generically it's referred to as ACE encoding. These two forms are relatively easy to distinguish. Obviously, the Unicode form is the non-ASCII variant, which should be fairly obvious to the naked eye. The difference between a regular ASCII domain name and an encoded IDN domain name is that encoded IDN domain names always begin with XN hyphen hyphen. So it's relatively easy to process at a registry level which domain names are related to IDNs and which ones are not. The ASCII version, prefixed with XN dash dash, is the only version that travels over the internet, with the exclusion of web forms or whatever is required when processing a domain name registration. Serving the actual names over the internet, XN dash dash is all that will be seen. So, just a little simple diagram. That's the current scenario without IDNs. Everything is ASCII in blue. And with IDNs, in an ideal scenario, the client and the server are Unicode aware, but the Unicode never actually ends up on the wire. So the encoding that's used by IDN, how does it work? It takes the Unicode form of a domain name, and it puts it through a series of processes which are documented by three different RFCs. The IDNA, Internationalized Domain Names for Applications, Name Prep, which is actually a subset of another RFC, and Punicode. I guess the important question, at least for our work within Centre, has been, why do you actually care how IDN works? The answer is that the way the protocol works makes some certain assumptions and has a certain impact on the way that you define your policy. So it's really good to have your head around how these protocols work when you're trying to define how to use IDN within your CCTLD. So I've really simplified the process, so it's not as direct as this, but hopefully it will illustrate what the difference between name prep, Punicode, and IDNA is. I've created a hopefully nonsense IDN on the left, and then there's the equivalent IDN encoding on the right, and it goes through a series of steps. The two key steps in terms of the concept would be name prep and Punicode, and overall it's governed by the IDNA specification. What name prep does is it does the normalization of a name. If we compare it to the ASCII world, at the moment, the only kind of normalization that happens in a domain name system is case insensitivity. So if you enter an uppercase domain name, it's equivalent to its lowercase companion. Unicode, by design, has many more different complicating aspects to the normalization process. Without going into detail, you can express the same character in multiple different ways with multiple different characters. And what NamePrep aims to do is reduce it down to a single representation of what could be many different representations in Unicode. It also blocks certain characters that are illegal in domain names. NamePrep is a subset of another RFC called StringPrep. And as I said, involves case folding, more advanced case folding than ASCII, as well as combining these variants and disabling certain characters. The Punicode step is the actual step that converts between Unicode and ASCII. It uses a compression algorithm that should be quite compact when dealing with same code points from the same languages. So it's optimized for use with Unicode in a way. Essentially, and I won't explain how it works, but it will compress Unicode representations into the ASCII equivalent. And what IDNA does is, apart from describing the whole process together, also mandates that you check each element of a domain name between periods. If a conversion is required, and it's not always required, for example, at the moment ccTLDs are not IDNs, so there's no requirement to process the top-level domain component of a domain. If a process is conducted that converts it from Unicode to ASCII, an XN dash dash prefix is added. From a policy point of view, the problem dealing with Unicode is that it is designed to represent all languages, which means that some of the benefits in having language-specific character sets are lost. This means that policies in different registries, and most registries will deal with one or two specific languages rather than all the world's languages, need to be designed to reflect Unicode's capability in this way. The reasons why IDNs by default allow the mostly complete Unicode set of characters in a domain name, and for most registries this is probably not desirable. For a ccTLD registry, in terms of policy, it's often important to know what a domain name means. For administrative reasons, it's often important to know how to write it, how to spell it, how to answer telephone calls to deal with a domain name. So for policy reasons mostly, there are a lot of reasons why a registry will opt to only deal with IDNs that they feel comfortable with, and that usually means using characters from a language with which they have the capability of dealing with. So most registries so far that have announced IDN plans indeed have those kind of restrictions. So once a registry has decided to restrict IDNs to a certain subset of those possible, it needs to identify how to do that kind of restriction. Within Unicode, there's many different groups of characters. They are generally arranged by the different scripts and languages that are capable with Unicode. These are often referred to as code pages, and it basically gives registries the potential of limiting domain names to certain subsets of the Unicode spectrum. Basically, the less restrictive the set of Unicode, the more hassle it is for the registry. So most registries will opt to reduce down to a very limited subset of characters that will enable them to represent their language. But on the other hand, there's a contrary opinion. Some registries state that what domain name they register is none of their business. So it's certainly not always the case that registries will seek to restrict in this way. So coming back to the Unicode list from the beginning, by default, if you just allow any domain name in the registry to be registered that starts with XN dash dash, you can register any of these characters in a domain name, plus many more. The most common approach is to simply restrict specific code points, simply going through Unicode, identifying which characters are required to represent the language and only allowing registration of those. However, another approach is restricting it to specific range of characters. For example, if you're the Greek registry, you could choose only those Greek characters that you think are necessary, but you may also opt to just allow the range of characters within Unicode required to represent Greek. One approach that has been relatively common and increasingly popular within our community at least is within Europe and within Centre, most of the languages that we deal with are Latin-based languages, so Western European, Central European can be represented with the Latin-based character set. Within Unicode, this is an extra 92 code points, which should in theory allow you to represent many languages within Europe. This is the restricted set that's being allowed by, for example, German registries such as .de, .at, .ch, .li, as well as Poland, which has got this restriction plus a few more. There is a problem with Unicode. There are many confusing alternatives within Unicode for what's potentially the same name. Within Unicode, you can probably express different names in different ways that perhaps are not intended. For example, the Cyrillic letter A looks pretty much identical to the Latin letter A, however they express two different ways in Unicode. These are not treated in the name prep process, so they need to be dealt with at a registry level if the registry considers those kind of equivalents to be confusing. The way this is done is to identify these characters and how they map to each other and create what's called a variant table. The concept being that if you have a variant table of different characters, then if a domain name contains one of those characters, then the alternates of that character are dealt with in a specific way. Upon registration, a registry that notices one of these variants will then somehow mark different variations in what's called a bundle. Just a simple example of how this might work. The sound between Denmark and Sweden is referred to as the Øresund. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but it's written two different ways, one on the left in Danish and one on the right in Sweden. But semantically, I guess both those letters mean the same thing in both languages. So the registry might choose to make them equivalent, creating a variant table saying if you have a domain name with a word on the left, you also get some sort of rights to the domain name on the right. Some of the alternatives that are available when using this kind of bundling is firstly to prohibit. If you register one of the variants, no one is allowed to have the alternative. Another is to assign the complete collection of different variants to the one registrant. A third is sort of a compromise. Initially, the registrant only gets what they ask for, but they can also request to have different variants if they need them. To be fair, Western Europe, it's not really a big deal. This is more of an issue for Asian languages. It seems to also be an issue in Greek, but within Western Europe, Western European Latin-based languages, there doesn't seem to be a huge need to do this kind of bundling. I guess to sort of equivalent it to some English examples. At the moment, there's no registry that I'm aware of that equivalents different spellings of colour, for example, whereas that's the same kind of concept of confusing alternatives. And secondly, I've got IAB and LAB as domain names, but if I use a capital on one, they look pretty much identical. So there are already some sort of confusion issues in ASCII domain names as it stands. There will be more with IDNs, but the argument is that there is no need for a registry to prescribe that kind of policy. This is another use of bundles within Iceland. They are using it as a pre-registration method, so that if you have an ASCII domain name, the equivalent is pre-registered for you. You have the ability to apply for it. Launching IDNs. Most registries are blocking IDNs until they know what they're doing. So if you try to register a domain name prefixed with XN dash dash, it will be forbidden. Launching IDNs is like liberalisation. As more domain names become available, registries have to deal with an influx of applications. As Poland said earlier, it's probably not so much if you're launching IDNs now, but when there's increased community awareness of IDNs, there's undoubtedly going to be high interest in claiming domain names that people want. So registries have to consider how to launch, first come, first serve, whether there's a sunrise period, whether to have an auction or a lottery or whatever. I'll fly through this. Registries need to become Unicode aware. They need to have special processing. They need to consider having Unicode not just in the domain name but throughout their systems. And they need to have support in all their interfaces. There's policy issues. Are you actually registering the Unicode version? Are you registering the XM-dash-dash version? Are you registering both? There's a lot of policy issues involved. One thing that can that's not really required by IDNs is traditionally registries have had a 3-character minimum on their domain names so that you can't register a 2-letter or a 1-letter domain name. Now, IDNs don't require you to have that kind of limit because an IDN by definition can't be shorter than 3 characters. However, to say to an end user that you can register a 1-letter IDN but not a 1-letter ASCII domain name might be a hard sell. So a number of registries have opted to limit IDNs to a minimum of 3 characters too, just so they don't have to explain the technology behind IDNs to make the customer satisfied. The biggest problem with deploying IDNs on from the supply side, from the registry side, is that there are a lot of issues with IDNs at the moment in that they're not universally deployed. Knowledge of IDNs is really limited to our industry, but within the ISP industry, the services industry, even the registrar community, IDNs are not really well supported or known about at this stage. The biggest problem on the demand side is that software support is really low. There's little incentive to use IDNs at the moment. It's really a hassle to use them for anything important. It's really just known by people that have developed IDNs and also in preventative registrations. There's a group starting called the IDN Software Consortium. Its aim is to try and spur IDN adoption within software. We had a meeting, there was attendees from different software vendors such as Microsoft. Microsoft stated their position that they're not going to put IDN support into IE until internationalized resource identifiers are standardized. So the end result is that Internet Explorer may not have IDN support for a number of years yet. There's URLs there if you're interested. So the progress on IDNs in Europe, and I'll try and be as quick as possible. This is the chart of when IDNs have been deployed. Basically, there have been a few deployments, such as Sweden, Poland in recent times, Denmark as well. However, a large number of registries are deploying on March 1st, the German-speaking registries as well as Hungary. And many other registries have indicated that they will deploy first half of this year ongoing. This survey is a little out of date. It's about a month and a half old. So there's probably even more news about it. I need to update it. Most are only going to deploy IDNs for local languages. Most are not going to implement bundles. Within Centre, we're working on a few documents. One is trying to define some language issues to try and help registries deploy. This will be released as an internet draft soon. Feedback would be useful. An old version is at that URL if you're interested. But this is one of the outputs of the work that we've done. This is just a sample of what it involves. It involves documenting different languages, what code points are required for them, and it helps guide registry policy. And it might also be useful for other applications, non-IDN related, that involve assessing what code points are needed for different languages. We're also working on instructional information both to registries and end users on how to use IDNs. It's hoped that this will assist in deployment. There are many challenges in deploying IDNs, more just little bugs and things that creep in. One issue is how to deal with Whois. Whois doesn't really have any policy on using Unicode, so we need to come up with something. That's some ongoing work. There's several challenges involved in deploying weird things. Like DNIC found that, I think it was the Swing library in Java, converted IDNs into ASCII equivalents with no explanation. which actually results in a completely different domain name, and various other problems have cropped up. We're looking towards standardizing some sort of approach for WHOIS as a stopgap so that every registry doesn't use WHOIS in a different way. The DNIC approach, which seems to be the nicest and cleverest, is if you ask for the ACE version with WHOIS, you get the ACE version back. If you ask in UTF-8, you get UTF-8 back. And they've also specified an extra flag that you can specify a certain character set if that's required. So, in brief, IDNs have been successfully deployed from a registry provision side. However, they're not really well deployed in a usage side. The registries feel probably that they know many of the pitfalls by now in deploying IDNs, but there really is a lack of IDN supporting software, which means the uptake will be very slow until that is resolved. Registries have deployed IDNs more to have them ready when they're needed rather than any kind of demand that's coming now. And there's a general lack of community awareness of how IDNs work. So, as I said before, IDN registrations are really limited to people that know what they're talking about. And let's hope it improves. So that was it. Sorry for taking up all your time. Any questions?
If I get a Chinese IDN email address, how do I type that in?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, that's another challenge of IDN deployment, is that it's not really, it's sort of localization in a way. If you have your local IDN you're giving out, it's probably only for local people that are going to use it. So presumably, if you had an international audience, you would give out two different addresses. Whether it's the XN dash dash form or just an ASCII form.
Last question.
Sorry, you talk about a non-ASCII domain name which is non-ASCII.ASCII code. And what about a domain name composed of a non-ASCII code that non-ASCII code?
I'm not sure what you mean.
The domain you talk about is a non-ASCII code that, let's say, NL.
Yes.
What about a domain name, non-ASCII code that...
All right. That's a policy decision. There's many that would like to have non-ASCII top-level domain names so that you can have a fully internationalized domain name. But that's really in the sphere of ICANN and so forth.
Yes, because to my mind it's more interesting. If someone can't use Latin words, so... you will not use it for the extension, okay?
Yes, particularly for non-Latin character sets, it's really important. But that's, I mean, technically there's no problem whatsoever. I think many registries will be happy to have that, but it's a discussion for policy.
If I talk about this, because we have this experience. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I've actually got a remote question. Which browsers support IDNs now without any plugins? From IE, which doesn't?
Mozilla does. The first version had a serious, well, semi-serious bug, but most recent versions work with IDNs. Opera does as well. So Mozilla and Opera, I don't know if there's any other ones you would consider major, but I think IE is the one that doesn't. However, IE has 90%+ market share, so it's really important.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, there's one other item which is on the agenda. We're actually running over time, so I'd like to get this business hopefully concluded as quickly as possible. We've tried now for an experiment now for the last couple of right meetings of merging what was the DNR forum with the DNS working group, and I'm still to reach consensus and decision from the people here that this is a good idea. There's been no communication from anybody on the mailing lists or to the working group chairs or co-chairs whether they think this is a good idea or a bad idea. So I'm assuming that definitely means that people think this is probably a good idea, because no one's complaining that this merger shouldn't really happen. So I would like to just propose that we decide, we agree now, that we merge the DNR forum with the DNS working group unless I hear differently. Does anyone get any objection to that? No, we're done. Thank you.
Thank you.